Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy, and the Sunday talk shows, brain dead as they are, were beset by the question, what happened to America's post-9/11 unity? Where did it go? How could we come together in response to the terrorist attack on 9/11, just as we came together in response to the Nazi siege in Europe? How could we come together in those instances and not today to deal with COVID or domestic insurrectionists, they ask? How is that? Where did our spirit of unity, e pluribus unum, where did it go? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 646-363-6DA, turnkey.pro text line. I'd like to hear your answer. I've got my own.
Oh, I want to hear your answer first.
Well, my answer has something to do with identitarian separatists, neo-Jacobins, and rule of men over rule of law politicians. Gosh, maybe the ascent of those groups, and there's a lot of overlap between the three, maybe that has something to do with the disunity afoot across the fruited plains. Is that possible? For example, the Young America's Foundation posted a video over the weekend of a student senator on the campus, in training to be an actual U.S. senator, student senator on the campus of Washington University in St. Louis, right? One of America's reputed better schools, caught on video throwing away the 2,977 American flags from the conservative students' 9/11 Never Forget Project Memorial. Like you saw at the polo grounds in Oak Brook, you know, posting the little flags for each person murdered on 9/11. Well, so students at Wash U did that, and then some man-bun neo-Jacobin was caught on video with three garbage bags full of them after he had pulled them all out.
Oh, now, why would he do that?
Because he's a neo-Jacobin. Maybe he was just cleaning up. Maybe this was school sanctioned. Well, it was a serious enough offense and an obvious enough one that the Washington University chancellor chimed in, sending an email to the Washington University community. I want to make it clear that as an institution, we find the actions of this student to be reprehensible. The removal of the flags impeded the ability of individuals to commemorate the lives lost on 9/11 and to process the trauma of that day. This act was seen as a personal affront by many at Wash U and beyond, and an affront to the ideas of our institution, and so on and so forth. But that's your college campus, and that's been your college campus for a long time. Now it's spilled out into all of the other cultural and civic institutions.
Well, I mean, there was a high school in the state of Washington, of course, Eastlake High School. They canceled Patriots Day to honor the victims of 9/11, you know, the worst terrorist attack to ever happen in this country, because they thought wearing red, white, and blue might offend some people at the school. So they canceled it.
Pam Keith Esquire, she's a officer of the court. She's a former Navy JAG Corps officer. She was a Democrat socialist candidate in Florida in 2020. Thankfully, she lost. She posted something that got a lot of support and has a lot of support. So you heard, gave you an example of the neo-Jacobins. Here's an example of the identitarian separatists. And that's really at the core of statements like you're about to hear. On 1-6-2021, 9/11-2001 ceased being the worst thing that happened in America to America in my lifetime. It's really weird and painful to process and say that, but it's the truth. And quite frankly, it's not even close. January 6th is worse than 9/11, and it's not even close. 2,977 Americans murdered, an attack on the Pentagon, an attack on the Twin Towers, so attack on a symbolic attack on a very system of free markets, and of course, Flight 93's destination was another institution that's sort of central to our representative republic. But 1-6 was worse. The only person killed at 1-6 was killed at the hands of a Capitol Police officer. The FBI.
Right.
Characterizing it as a bunch of one-offs, not an insurrection, a desecration. It's not defending those who broke the law in 1-6, as we have said from the beginning. But to compare it to 9-11, this is identitarian separatism.
American pride. I mean, back to that high school, though. They thought people would be offended by American pride.
Yeah, well, that's neo-Jacobinism. Yep. That's the destruction of American identity and American history. That's just another. So there's another neo-Jacobin moment.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line.
Fairfax, Virginia. Fairfax, Virginia school board. There's a woman on that school board who's basically a Muslim separatist. Her name is Abrar Omesh. She got into a squabble with her fellow Democrat socialists, mostly of the champagne variety, on that school board about a 9/11 resolution. She wanted it to be a little bit more balanced to reflect the demonization of Muslims, so she says, in America after 9/11. And so her resolution was less about those murdered on 9/11. In fact, it represented one of the 11 paragraphs in her resolution. It was to teach 9/11 and its social and political impacts on our community and our country as a lesson in the dangers of collective blame, xenophobia, and the demonization of entire populations. The school board denounces two decades of policies, actions, and rhetoric which disproportionately impacted Arab Americans, American Muslims, and those perceived to be Arabs or Muslims here in Fairfax County and across the country. That's the real lesson of 9/11. And do I need to get into rule of men versus rule of law, Pauls, when it comes to any constitutional restraints on what they do, when it comes to any accountability for what they do at the FBI, at the IRS? Maybe those developments over the last 20 years that have sped up considerably over the pre-9/11 America, maybe that has something to do with the inability to find unity of purpose on so many issues. Could that be it? Tony and Roselle, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Good morning, everybody. Thanks for taking the call. I was calling about the guy who was collecting the flags at the university. Mm-hmm. I found a statement that he had written online last night saying that he was taking them down, not to facing anything, but he was taking them down to bag up and take somewhere else, I forgot where he said, and plant them with his own protest, his own notes about American, you know, crimes across the globe, the hegemony or the word, I forget the word. But basically, he was stealing their protest and their display to create his own protest elsewhere. That was his official line. He wasn't desecrating anything. I guess stealing, that's a different word now.
Right. Yeah, thanks for the call, Tony. Right. Well, that's actually the definition of desecration, is to destroy somebody else's memorial because you want to turn what they presented into something that has a different meaning. Go make your own. There's a concept. Craig in Mount Greenwood.
Hey, good morning, Dan and Amy, and thank you for taking my call. It's twofold. First, you got this diapered and demented derelict in the White House doing everything you can to divide us with damn masks and vax and all that kind of stuff. And then you got the school system, the other part of it, training up our kids and everything, telling them how rotten and no good our country is, and how we took everything from us and turning us against each other, where there's some of us are patriotic. We love our flags. We love our soldiers. I mean, that. And they're training the kids to hate it and think that the parents, that us, that we're nuts. And they're doing, listen, it's so messed up with these leftists and Marxists, savages, tearing up our country and tearing up our society. I can't even believe it.
Thanks for the call, Craig. Well, you know, when we come back, I want to play some clips from George W. Bush's, President W.'s, speech at Shanksville over the weekend, because I think the interpretation from conservatives is a little bit off. But in terms of this unity thing, I mean, of course, the great irony of the great confusion from the punditry and the polls on the Sunday talk shows 48 hours after President Biden demonizes a subset of the American population, those who haven't been vaccinated, as bad people. And again, the absolute befuddlement as to why we don't have post 9/11 unity 20 years later. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
From the Matrix Home Solutions Studios, this is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
It's America First with me, Sebastian Gorka, tonight, starting at 10, right before Hugh Hewitt, only on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Before Mike Sapp's news, we were talking about this disunity problem that the Sunday talk show pundits have identified in America. They're so on top of things. And I was suggesting there's a real explanation for why we're not 9-12 America unified against a common enemy right now, is because, as Lionel Shriver wrote in her 9-11 piece to her brother who died when the South Tower collapsed, we've learned to terrorize ourselves over the last 20 years. We've turned inward and on one another, and that is mainly at the hands of identitarian separatists, neo-Jacobins, and rule of men over rule of law politicians. That's the explanation you didn't hear on any of the Sunday talk shows, even from the erstwhile center-right representatives on their, you know, deep-thinking panels. Bunch of nonsense. Those shows are unwatchable. That talk about more poison in the culture. These shows that present themselves as, you know, policy oriented and civic minded people of some repute coming together to discuss the issues of the day. It's a bunch of hacks reciting talking points, is what it is. But that doesn't mean that we should accept the left's interpretation of every utterance. And so I wanted to talk briefly, at least, about President W.'s address at Shanksville, Pennsylvania, of course, the site of Flight 93. During the memorial service, where he talked about present-day threats, and he mentioned domestic terrorists and how that was interpreted. How did you interpret W.'s comments? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 64636 DA turnkey.pro text line. Here's what he said.
We have seen growing evidence that the dangers to our country can come not only across borders, but from violence that gathers within. There is little cultural overlap between violent extremists abroad and violent extremists at home. But in their disdain for pluralism, in their disregard for human life, in their determination to defile national symbols, they are children of the same foul spirit, and it is our continuing duty to confront them.
Now, I have a lot of problems with W, his presidency, the Bush political dynasty. But is that just speaking? And I know he and his family have great antipathy for Trump, but did you take that as just speaking about January 6th and trying to make synonymous 9/11 and January 6th? Because I didn't. He went on to say this.
In the weeks and months following the 9/11 attacks, I was proud to lead an amazing, resilient, united people. When it comes to the unity of America, those days seem distant from our own. Malign force seems at work in our common life that turns every disagreement into an argument, and every argument into a clash of cultures. So much of our politics has become a naked appeal to anger, fear, and resentment. That leaves us worried about our nation and our future together.
How did you interpret what he was saying in terms of who and what he was referencing?
Well, I thought immediately of mass shooters, like domestic terrorists who go in mm-hmm. and kill people for certain religious beliefs, or if they're Jewish, you know, things like that. That's what I thought of. Not, I didn't jump right away to 1-6.
I saw too many conservative pundits getting whipped into a frenzy over those comments. Because the interpretation was that he was making a 1-6 reference, and only a 1-6 reference.
Oh, I don't know what.
Yeah, I don't know what was in his mind, but I know what he said before. About like back last summer, yes, he denounced what happened on January 6th. Well, who didn't? But last summer when our cities were being laid siege to by vandals. He also spoke out against that. Who didn't? Well, actually, a lot of people.
Well, a lot of people didn't.
Yeah.
Did you hear Obama come out and say anything like "Stop burning down, stop looting Chicago. You're destroying the town." No.
But there's this thing where we want to interpret statements like that in a way that is we're being targeted, or he's talking about 1-6 and he's trying to paint Trump supporters as all Trump supporters, all Trump voters as domestic extremists, as malign forces. And I don't know what he was intending to say, but I know based on past statements that if he was trying to just say that, then he said much more previously. So why don't we instead take those words and say, yeah, we agree with W. We agree with W when it comes to Antifa, when it comes to people trying to tear down our history, when it comes to people trying to divide us by race and every other non-behavioral characteristic, the identitarian goons, the violent extremists that we saw burn down America's cities last summer. Why do we have to go to sort of some 1-6 defense? Oh, he's trying to make everybody who voted for Trump into some 1-6 jackal who breached the Capitol. I don't think that's what he was doing. And more to the point, I don't think we should be interpreting it that way, because it is much broader than that. And so we should focus people's attention on those malign forces that I've described both a few minutes ago and reiterated at present, shouldn't we?
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment.
Victor at Midway.
Yes, good morning, guys. I didn't watch the speech live, but from what I just heard, I interpret it as him referring to Antifa and BLM, because, I mean, we did have a whole year of the rioting compared to one day of January 6th, which also was proven to be 226 Antifa members arrested disguised as Trump supporters. So that's how I took it.
All right. Thanks for the call, Victor. Kip in Stillman Valley.
Yeah, good morning. Are you there?
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, we're here.
Yeah, okay, great. Hey, that's exactly what that last gentleman had said, but it came when the presidential historian that was on NBC at the time, when Jenna Bush was there in Andy Card, I think that's his name, that told Bush about the planes hitting at that grade school. He went in to say that it was all about the conservatives, and that's who he was referring to. And that goes for all the other people that had talked about it, went right to the bad, bad conservatives. You know, and amazing how they're sitting here trying to talk about unity. These are the same people that downgraded and lied about Donald Trump for 4-5 years and still going after basically an innocent man, while you have the president that's in office right now destroying this country in our name all over the world. It's just very disturbing and evil, you know?
Thanks for the call, Kip. Well, again, I expect that from whatever constitutes a presidential historian to NBC News. Just to reiterate, what I'm saying is we don't need to adopt their interpretation of those statements that were not specific to BLM or Antifa or 1-6. we should use that as an opportunity to agree about malign forces, to talk about extremists, and to identify who present a real threat to America's future. And it is not a couple handfuls of one-offs on January 6th. It is not Aryan Nation.
Right.
Nobody's defending those individuals or those absurd, ignorant groups, but they don't present some existential threat to the republic. What does, or who does, are those people in charge of all of our Marxist-driving cultural and civic institutions who've taken over the streets, who wanted in Portland, places like Portland, who want to defund police, who burned down police stations in Seattle. And that's, we should use the occasion of Bush's words not to be in a defensive posture, but to be in an offensive one.
Good point.
Pete and Racine, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Good morning. I agree with what you had just said. Now, former President Bush, the comments that he made were directly reflecting what you had said with all these different groups and what's going on in this country. He was polite enough that this day was about the people that lost their lives, so he didn't go into it in any more detail. But it's domestic terrorism when there's people that are more than happy to kill, destroy, steal, and totally disregard authority. That's just what our overseas domestic terrorists do as well. So you can't separate evil, disrespect for authority, or anything. They are the same thing no matter who you're talking about.
Thanks for the call, Pete. Tom in Blue Island.
Morning, Dan and Amy. So, Dan, I'm generally, obviously, enough not one to go sideways on you, but I disagree with you on this totally. He sent this country to war in 2001. I voted for Bush twice and supported him up and down. I don't disagree with the idea of your point, but if that was his case, this was not the forum for it. I believe what he said in that forum was the most disgusting thing I've ever heard a president say because of the confusion it could lead to, Dan. And his siding up with these other globalists, this gets back to Trump's inauguration speech when he called Trump's speech a bunch of crazy SHI. I just disagree with you on this one, Dan. Well, I believe he's been encompassed the globalism.
Well, thanks for the call, Tom. Fair enough, but whether Bush is a globalist or not is sort of tangential to the issue. And I think actually Shanksville was an appropriate time to bring up the state of America 20 years later. I think the 9/11 remembrances are absolutely appropriate venues to bring up what has happened in the intervening 20 years. We should be asking ourselves all the time, are we more safe? Are we more free? What are the things that divide us? Who are the malign forces, to borrow the phrase that he used? You know, I think there's the disappointment and even disgust with the messenger being W because what transpired during his two terms, and I understand that and I agree with a lot of it, versus the actual message. So I didn't find that disrespectful or offensive. Joe on the south side.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Just wanted to make a quick comment. I didn't necessarily jump the gun either as far as going straight to negative town, assuming that his statement by any means was directly against 1-6. My point is, why are we having to use the word interpret when it came to a speech? I feel like an ex-president should be making a statement crystal clear on what happened all last year across our country, how we have these groups tearing down our history from city to city, trying to erase it, and it gets brushed off like it's nothing. And mm-hmm. Like a gentleman said earlier, you know, what happened at the Capitol, yes, it was atrocious, but there was also several dozen, if not a couple hundred people now known who were not Trump supporters. So as a president, his message should be crystal clear and going against any and all terrorism inside of our country. That's it.
Thanks for the call, Joe. I wanted to include this this positive 911 story that is not going to be picked up most places because, well, it involves Pope John Paul II. It involves the Catholic Church. And unless it's social justice Catholics who despise Catholicism advancing the flag of these leftist forces I've described, then it won't be covered in the D.C. press corps. But the Cardinal and Archbishop of New York at the time, at 9/11, I'm talking about, was Cardinal Egan. And after 9/11, he did not give any interviews for more than a decade.
Really?
He just...
why not?
He just felt, you know, traumatized. I mean, not so much he felt traumatized, although he certainly did, but he just felt that this was such a watershed moment in American history that he wanted to sort of work quietly behind the scenes as opposed to...
in front of the camera, that makes
sense. Yeah, as opposed to taking such a public profile. Well, he did give an interview after that decade of silence in the media to Drew Mariani, who's over at Relevant Radio. It's a great program at Relevant Radio, Catholic station. And he talked about one thing that he saw on 9/11. And, well, just listen to the story.
Standing in front of the hospital with me, in scrubs, and we were all wearing gas masks, was a young doctor. And at a certain point, I noticed that he was shaking. And I said, "Doctor, I have a room inside here with some tea and coffee. You better come in. What's going on?" He said, "My father was in the 103rd floor. And I said, "Well, doctor, you better come in and sit down and get a hold of yourself." He said to me, "No, Cardinal Egan," he said, "I'm a doctor. I'm going to stand here. The injured are coming, and this is where a doctor should be. I can worry about my own grief later." Yeah. Well, 18 days after 9/11, I had to go to Rome to head a synod of bishops. And shortly after I arrived, Pope John Paul II asked me to lunch. And he said to me, "Tell me everything that happened." So in the course of speaking to him, I told him about this doctor. And he said to me, "Has he finished medical school?" I said, "Yes, but he's got a lot of bills to pay." I said, "He's got to do a internship and a residency." And he said, "How much will that cost him?" I said, "I don't know." He said, "Find out." So I found out and informed him after I came home. And Pope John Paul II gave a check to the substitute Secretary of State, sent him to New York, and together we gave the doctor a gift from Pope John Paul II. Wow. These are the kinds of things that you'd never know about. Wow. But the Holy Father was so touched by the courage, the nobility of that man, as I was. And that gives you one example of what happened.
Oh, it's a beautiful gift.
That's back when the church was aligned with the catechism, was able to speak with moral clarity about evil in this world, as Pope John Paul did about Soviet communism and communism the world over, totalitarianism the world over. That's unfortunately another institution that has fallen off over the last two decades, another source of our disunity. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. So the Democrat Socialists in the House are expected to propose raising corporate and capital gains taxes less than Biden had suggested initially. Because as long as they get the $3.5 trillion, who really cares if they have any ability to pay for it? So to try and make it more palatable, still significant. You're talking about essentially a 25% increase in the corporate tax, plus a 3 percentage point surtax on individual income above $5 million, and about a 20% increase in the long-term capital gains rate. That's the proposal against the backdrop of this $3.5 trillion spend. And while Joe Manchin and Kristen Sinema still hold fast, we'll see. This is all posturing, of course. Nancy Pelosi and Comrade Bernie and the bar wench from the Bronx are basically taking the posture of all or nothing, $3.5 trillion or nothing. For more on what the impacts of what could transpire, the various things that could transpire, watered down on the tax increases and the spend versus the full Monty that Pelosi and gang want, what that would mean for markets and economic opportunity and growth. Please be joined by our friend Jim Urio, who's a Fox Business contributor and the proprietor of Brandt's Restaurant in Palatine. Jim, thanks for being with us. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Your reaction to what you saw proposed on the tax side and what we know has been proposed on the spend side.
Well, just to shed some light on one part of it, is that by the Democrats' own admission, like everybody knows this, this is not a surprise to anybody who looks at least one to two derivatives below the headline of raising capital gains tax. Every time capital gains tax has been raised, the revenues from that tax goes lower, not higher. And every time it's been lowered, the revenues from that tax goes higher, not lower. And this is not any sort of weird voodoo magic. This is obvious of why that happens, because as capital gains tax get higher, people don't take capital gains. They borrow money against things. They hedge things more, and the motivation's not there to sell things. Now, what I'm getting at is that they know this. They know that raising the capital gains tax will not raise revenue. It would actually decrease revenue, and they keep pretending that these taxes are to pay for the spending, where they've also shown us full well that they now adhere to the MMT theory, modern monetary theory, that suggests that they do not need to raise money from taxes. They can just deficit spend all they want and even create money, which right now is illegal, but they're trying to, at some point it might not be. So this is all nonsense. But the one good thing I take from it is that the notion that they keep kind of dialing down a little bit, it to me seems that their heart is not really in it. For them, the show of acting like they want to be the guys who are coming after rich people is more important than actually coming after rich people. And I have my fingers crossed when I'm saying this, because this is a hope more than a prediction. But I think that's what's happening. But the markets, you know, the markets are telling you that they don't believe them. They don't believe they have the guts to do it. That's what I see right now.
And you have Morgan, this is against the backdrop of Morgan Stanley's chief investment officer predicting a 20% drawback in the markets. I mean, he's been predicting it actually since the fourth quarter of last year. So I guess if he holds to his prediction long enough, it's bound to become true at some point. But I mean, what do you think? Is this something approximating what has been proposed, even on the spend side, already built into the markets? And this is all going to be it's all going to turn on what Jay Powell does or doesn't do starting in November.
Well, absolutely. It turns on what Jay Powell does or doesn't do. Now, I think we're at a much more of an inflection point in markets and our economic condition than people think. And I'm going to rewind the tape 6 short business days ago, the Friday when we saw the unemployment number, where the unemployment number came in bad. And that's under the backdrop of persistently high non-transitory inflation. So Jay Powell, so the word that nobody likes to mention out loud is stagflation. So we have to whisper it, because, of course, it's early in the game. But if inflation is going higher and economic data is showing us that a slowdown is here, then the Fed is backed into a corner and they have to decide what to do. Now, the right thing to do is to pull back stimulus to fight the inflation and let the 20 to 40% correction in the stock market happen, because they're the enabler. They're allowing the federal government to just use these asinine policy tools that to me almost seem like they're designed to slow the economy, and they know deep down that the Fed doesn't have the guts to remove stimulus. If the Fed did that, I think we could get back to some sort of equilibrium level that we're not at now.
Do you think since the incentives, you know, $300 extra a week in Illinois, that ended, I think it's this week or last week, I do believe. Do you think more people now will jump back into the workforce instead of sitting at home?
Well, that's a good point. And I think the market is telling us let's wait and see about the economic condition once that the child tax credit, the absolutely ridiculous eviction moratorium that I still don't understand, the extended unemployment benefits, the loan forbearance. These are all things that, you know, there was $10 million open jobs, according to the JOLTS report. And at the same time, the federal government was trying just to bribe, pay, just beg people not to work. And if we believe those programs are really sunsetting right now, which I think the market does, and that's why it's a little bit buoyant today, and that's why the sell-off of last week was kind of, I mean, it didn't really have a ton of conviction. It was 4 days in a row, but it still was only 3% off the highs. So I think that that's a big deal.
I don't know about you, but my friend that owns a restaurant told me last night he has to pay barbacks $20 an hour cash in order for them to work because he cannot find anybody to work in his restaurant.
Well, yes, I hear that from a lot of restaurant people all over that they can't find anybody. We're just going with some short staff at Brands, which I said we don't have the right amount of people to service people properly. But it seems like our people are understanding. But to underscore that, that is absolutely true that the restaurant business is starved for employment that just won't come off the sidelines. And then, I think you think about this, the eviction moratorium, just to circle back to that. So yeah, these people are being told there's a million jobs open for them, millions and millions, but you can't get one of those jobs to pay your rent. I'm just dumbfounded by all of this.
Yeah, but here's the problem with that. Talking about the 300, the impact, it seems to me, is unclear because you still have all the beneficiaries of transfer payments still have significant largesse provided by taxpayers, from food stamps to $3,000 per kid to rent paid. Plus, in many states, you have the enhanced unemployment benefits continuing at the state level. And so to me, it's unclear that the removal of the Fed overlay is going to fill a significant percentage of those 11 million unfilled jobs.
No, the removal of the Fed overlay is not going to solve those economic problems. It's actually going to pull back the wallpaper and show the condition of the wall and show how these policies are terrible. And then things could get bad, but the Fed cannot. See, this is, you know, back prior to hyperinflation in the Weimar Republic, this is the exact same dilemma that the Reichsbank had. It's you see this inflation, you know that if you pull back what's causing the inflation, it could cause an cataclysm is probably the wrong word. It's a little too hyped up, but it's certainly possible. But if you pull back that stimulus, it could be a bad economic reset. But I still think they have to do that because we are beginning to risk, you know, real sustained higher inflation, real perhaps currency problems.
And we're also now hearing rumors about revising GDP growth numbers for the fourth quarter of this year, third and fourth quarter, because Wall Street Journal, the front page story over the weekend, you know, a lot of restaurants going back to limiting the capacity or emptying out their dining rooms because of the Delta variant. So because we're in this merry-go-round on COVID, you have one step forward, two steps back going on in a lot of industries, starting with restaurants and no doubt, retail.
So many have closed, and we see it happening. I hear, you know, our restaurant's been fine and things are good. We have a ton of outdoor space, but I'm concerned about what happens in the winter. But what I'm more concerned about, and this began, and I don't know, I've been writing volumes on this for the last month. Everywhere the Delta variant has struck, it had about a 2-month cycle from bottom to top and then fell off precipitously. That was going to happen around this week. I mean, I still am sticking with that. And nationwide, it is falling off hard, but in Illinois, it hasn't quite yet. But that's why I thought the governor here was struggling so quickly to try to make, put those mandates back in place so he can claim some sort of victory when it goes down on its own. That to me is just, you know, you sit back and you think, wow, would they really do something like that, just putting these things in place? And the answer to that is, of course they would, and they did. I'm not convinced that some of these Democratic governors, at the beginning of all this, when faced with these huge fiscal issues and unfunded pensions, weren't really in some ways kind of glad that their economy was falling apart, because then they can point to the rubble and say to the federal government, gosh, there's nothing we can do. Look at what COVID did to us. Can we have some money? And that's worked pretty effectively from Illinois.
So does Powell's decision on beginning tapering in November and extending that through, you know, the second quarter of next year, does that turn on whether it's $1.5 trillion versus $3.5 trillion? Does that matter in terms of impact, both on in terms of what he does as well as in terms of how America's economy performs?
Well, it has to. It has to, you know, because $3.5 trillion injected in the economy is going to cause a tremendous amount of short-term demand, fake demand, and again, consider that juxtaposed against the real live notion that there still exists huge supply disruptions, and that's one of the reasons why we're seeing this inflation. But if it was $1 trillion, I don't think he would feel as motivated to taper as quickly. And by the way, the taper thing, you know, talking about tapering is much, much different than actually doing it. In my head, I go back to a time, it was in August, I think about 3 or 4 years ago, where James Bullard came out one day saying that, you know, the Fed was going to allow interest rates to normalize and go back higher. And then in the next 3 days, the stock market cracked like 7 or 8%. Now, granted, 7 or 8% is not the biggest thing. And then by the end of that same week, he came out again and said, you know, the case for raising rates has changed quite a bit. Now, the only thing that has changed is that the stock market broke 8%. So the question is, do they want to be at the helm where there's any sort of big stock market correction where everyone can point a finger and blame them? And I don't know. I guess it's just human nature not to want to be the bad guy. But if you keep pushing it down the road, somebody's going to be the real bad guy when it all of a sudden adjusts.
Well, the other thing that's happening, too, sort of the political drama behind the scenes is if you want to be the bad guy, Jay Powell, then we're going to replace you. We're not going to re-up you. I mean, there's a lot of leftists that want Jay Powell replaced by somebody that is even more of an acolyte of modern monetary theory than he is, so that the good times can keep rolling.
It's absolutely absurd that he has to, like, be his back's against the wall. There's really, and I see, he seems like a good guy to me. I don't think the Fed is doing a good job in general, but I worry that they're going to, if he doesn't give them the just rampant dovishness that they want, they're going to replace him with someone who's more leftist, and all of a sudden they're going to be asking the Fed to fix climate change, to fix wealth inequality, which, by the way, is absolutely comical when you consider over the last 40 years the Fed has been one of the main drivers of wealth inequality. I know to go into that equation would probably be a little too, you know, in the weeds for this show, but believe me, it's true. And now to ask them to be the ones to fix it, we're in bizarro world, Dan.
I was reading something, reports that outside of urban office space, actually commercial real estate is recovering quite well, multifamily back to pre-2020 and in a lot of cities, rents rising nicely. Of course, that's inflation related too. But the dire predictions about commercial real estate being an anchor, were those overstated?
Yeah, I think they were. And I think that with, you know, part of the $120 billion buying a month and the injecting money into the economy as much as they have was to try to support the real estate market in all forms. And I think they've done that. I will actually even argue that they've overshot the mark. Why in the world would they be buying $40 billion of mortgage-backed bonds a month when the home prices have completely skyrocketed? But then, you know, commercial is going to always follow to some degree, despite the fact that the story was everybody was leaving cities, no one was going to go back to the office anymore. I think that it doesn't matter as much as the fact that they're just the market is awash in free money.
I mean, just for clarity, going back to those proposed rate increases in corporate tax rate and long-term capital gains, you know, it's a few percentage points, but on a percentage basis, those are big increases. Is that already built into, or the level of increase, if there is any, that will have a material impact, regardless of whether the spend is zero, $1.5 trillion, or $3.5 trillion.
I think that the market is saying that's not going to happen. And I think the market, if it really believed that all these tax increases were going to happen, I think it would be somewhat catastrophic. Because remember, you know, small businesses still, the government has an absolute foot on the neck of small business, and it happened with the lockdowns. And that's why I read the other day that 90,000 restaurants have closed. But now they're going after medium-sized business with the new COVID regulations. I mean, that's, you know, that can be a heavy weight for 100 employee business to now have to regulate that, and they don't seem to care. So they're just raising regulations and raising taxes, and realistically, it's all the same thing. So I think the market is saying it's not really going to happen. But if it did happen, it's a huge deal. I mean, you know, so many companies right now are just hanging on by a thread. To add a couple more percentage points, just no, it's an awful, awful idea.
Amy, you know how Jim Urio, Jim Urio is doing very well and he's hedged properly.
How?
He uses phrases like somewhat catastrophic, just in passing, just flippantly, somewhat catastrophic, not a big deal.
Yeah, it's going to be, it's kind of catastrophic, but not really.
Yeah,
you know,
it's Hindenburg, not Titanic. Yeah. I got you. Great. Thanks so much, Jim. We appreciate that. Jim Urio, Fox Business analyst, owner of Brandt's, which I hear has the best burger in town there in Palatine. in the region, I should say.
You didn't have the burger. You didn't even give it a try. When
well, the ribs are good.
The burger is the best.
I will endorse the ribs for sure.
And your tacos now, too.
Oh, the fish tacos. I love those. That's what I have tonight. Yeah.
Amy's keeping up on your menu. Very good. Jim Urio, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Here you go.
And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Listen to Dan and Amy on your smartphone. Download the AM560 mobile app today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
Coming up on Chicago's Morning Answer.
France's former top vaccine guy calls the Western COVID policy completely stupid and unethical. We'll start there with Dr. Alan Moy, Vice President of the John Paul II Medical Research Institute and a pulmonologist, 636.
And the fight over the vaccine mandate heats up and people are quitting their jobs.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, reacting over the weekend to Biden's vaccine mandate announcements on Thursday, was our friend from Johns Hopkins University, Dr. Marty Makary, saying this: the focus on natural immunity in terms of the need for more flexibility. Take a listen.
We could benefit from a more civil dialogue and a more flexible vaccine requirement, one that accounts for natural immunity, which the studies have shown is 27 times more effective in preventing symptomatic COVID. A policy that's more flexible in terms of spacing out the doses. They may not be able to get both doses in by the deadline if they want to space out the doses by 3 months, which the new research shows is at least three times more effective. And finally, some people may benefit from one dose, either those who had the infection or adolescents where there's a concern around the heart inflammation of the second dose. So the policy should be more flexible.
Yeah, that sort of texture is lost on the COVIDians, of course. But on the issue of natural immunity and the study of Israel that Makary was referring to, 27 times more effective than the vaccines. Tony Fauci was asked about that.
And?
By Sanjay Gupta on CNN. And listen to this answer. After months of people like us banging the natural immunity drum as an important part of the overall discussion driving COVID response. And now listen to what Tony Fauci is saying.
There was a study that came out of Israel about natural immunity, and basically the headline was that natural immunity provides a lot of protection, even better than the vaccines alone. What are people to make of that? So as we talk about vaccine mandates, I get calls all the time. People say, I've already had COVID, I'm protected, and now the study says maybe even more protected than the vaccine alone. Should they also get the vaccine? How do you make the case to them?
You know, that's a really good point, Sanjay. I don't have a really firm answer for you on that.
What?
He's sitting that one out?
I don't have a firm answer for you on those who have natural immunity from being infected and recovering, getting the vaccine.
Natural immunity is stronger than the vaccine, Dr. Fauci. Don't you know that?
Well, he just said I don't have a firm answer.
Right, I know.
But that's not what he's been saying. That's not what all the COVIDians have been saying up until that interview. They've been saying everybody, the mandates do not exempt people that have been infected and recovered. In fact, you have lawsuits that are pending. People like the George Mason University professor that we spoke of that filed suit against George Mason University because natural immunity from being infected and recovering, and the university is requiring him to be vaccinated anyway. This has been one size fits all. Right up until the point that Tony Fauci says he doesn't have a firm answer on the topic, as you heard Makary saying, you know, a topic that demands more flexibility, mandates that demand more flexibility. I mean, that is seismic. And I don't hear anybody reacting to what Fauci said on CNN. It's remarkable. All of a sudden, natural immunity, which how many people have been infected and recovered? 80 million? Mm-hmm. We don't know exactly.
And some didn't even know they had it. Yeah.
I mean, holy cow.
That's huge news. That should be the headline of Block A in every newscast on every cable station.
I don't have a firm answer.
Oh my God.
We're 18 months in. How do you not have a firm answer? And by the way, how is the answer you had been giving, how did that become less firm? The Israeli study? On another topic, before we get to our next guest, there's so much to cover on this topic, as per usual.
To get something off my chest, too.
Nebraska Governor Pete Ricketts was on with Chris Wallace, who just discovered that cloth masks don't provide much protection last week. Last week, he discovered that.
Last week, yeah.
He was aghast.
He was stunned into silence. You guys should all watch it. I'll tweet it out.
Speaking with the dean of the public health school at Brown University, and was, the last guy to the dance on cloth masks. But anyway, Pete Ricketts, Nebraska governor's on, and he poses this question that you're hearing from COVIDians a lot to Pete Ricketts in terms of what the L.A. Public School District did, which is to mandate vaccines for all students. And we'll see more of that coming, particularly when under 12 is approved for the vaccination, which could be as soon as next month, according to Dr. Scott Lieb, the former FDA commissioner. So Pete Ricketts has asked the question, you know, all these other inoculations kids have to get to go to school, so why not COVID?
You say it's a personal choice. In fact, to attend school in your state of Nebraska, children must be vaccinated against a number of diseases. Let me put them up on the screen. They must be vaccinated against diphtheria, tetanus and pertussis, polio, measles, mumps and rubella, hepatitis B, and chicken pox. Why are those mandates that parents in your state must comply with and do comply with routinely, why is it that they're not so objectionable and such a violation of personal freedom, but Biden's vaccine mandates are?
Well, for all those that you just listed, there's a long history that parents have had the opportunity to see how those things have been implemented. And there's still a lot of people out there who don't know what to trust. And in fact, this is really an outcome of what the CDC has done, because they've flip-flopped on so many issues, whether it's masks or whether you have to mask after being vaccinated and so forth. There's just a lot of people out there who don't know who to trust right now. And so by having the government force it on, you're not building the trust where we have the trust with those other vaccines.
Well, Pete Ricketts is right, but he missed something big, didn't he? Kids don't get sick. The risk is de minimis. There, as was reported over the weekend, there have been more children shot in Chicago this year than have died nationally from COVID.
Wow. Three from COVID have died in Chicago, 34 killed by gunfire, 287 now shot.
For more on all of this, we're pleased to be joined again by Dr. Alan Moy. He's a pulmonologist. He's also the vice president of the John Paul II Research Institute out Iowa way. Dr. Moy, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Good morning.
What about the Fauci response on natural immunity that he doesn't have a firm answer? But is there some sort of sea change going on in the CDC public health world that we were unaware of until Fauci's utterance?
I think that the issue of the observations and data from Delta has really started to confuse the public health authorities. Because prior to that point, the narrative was the vaccine immunity was superior to natural immunity. That was the narrative from them. And so when they start to see the data from Delta that the vaccine was becoming much less effective because of the variants, as I have said over and over again, that the vaccine has a narrow mechanism of action. It targets a fraction of the virus at the spike protein level, and it puts pressure on the virus to adapt, to mutate at the spike protein level. And that's what you're seeing with Delta, and that the vaccine effectiveness is waning, and you're having these variants like Delta. It is causing the public health authorities to see this is not aligning up what we expected. And so it's creating a lot of confusion about from the public health authorities, what do we do now? What do we say? Because the data is not supporting the vaccine.
So what's the answer then? Booster shots?
I'm sorry.
Well, I said, what is the answer? If the variant is not, or if the vaccine is not being is not effective, is the solution another shot?
Well, the solution, at least from Israel, and what they're trying to do is to give a third booster. The problem is that it's not necessarily going to be effective because the spike protein has dramatically changed. The other problem is that there are studies that the antibodies that are being raised from the vaccine with respect to when it's exposed to the Delta virus actually may enhance the infection. The neutralizing antibodies are becoming less effective, and so there is an imbalance of enhancing antibodies to neutralizing antibodies, and you might actually, with some of these rare Delta variants, you may actually increase the severity of the infection. So the answer is a recognition among the public that what is exactly be transparent. What is exactly is the efficacy and safety of the vaccines? And let's start using early treatment for those patients at risk. They have the government, big tech, every mainstream media have censored early treatment for COVID. And so until then, we're going to have to deal with these push for boosters, which I think is going to be futile.
Well, on this issue of what I think the term is, correct me if I'm wrong, antibody-mediated viral enhancement, this idea that the vaccines make vaccinated more vulnerable, not less. This has been an idea that's been kicked around here in the public arena to some extent, where it's not quashed, as you were sort of referencing, Dr. Robert Malone and others. But now we have a data set out of Britain, the NHS reporting cases reported by week for 3 weeks in August, last month. They looked at this 3 week period, and for the age groups 40 to 49, 50 to 59, 60 to 69, and 70 to 79, the rates of infection among vaccinated with two doses per 100,000 in all of those age cohorts, 40 to 80, was higher than the rates of infection among the not vaccinated. Is that what's happening there?
Well, you know, it's hard to say. It's very possible. The problem that we're dealing with a lot of.
Oh, did we lose Dr. Moy?
Yes, we did.
All right. Let's take a break and let's try to get Dr. Moy back because I want to answer that question. We got a few others. We'll be right back.
It's what Chicago is talking about. It's Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan and Amy on AM 560, The Answer.
The Lou Dobbs Financial Report is brought to you by Signature Bank, helping local businesses succeed. Visit signaturebank.bank for your commercial banking needs.
I'm Lou Dobbs. Grubhub and Uber Eats file lawsuits against New York City. Inflation chewing into the American economy and the feds on the trail of airline refunds. Those stories next.
As you know, my friend Mike Lindell has a passion to help everyone get the best sleep of your life. He created the best pillow and Mike created the Giza Dream Bed Sheets. Mike found the world's best cotton called Giza. It's ultra soft and breathable, but extremely durable. Mike's Giza sheets come with a 60-day money-back guarantee and a 10-year warranty. Mike's latest incredible deal is the sale of the year. For a limited time, you will receive 50% off Giza Dream Sheets. You'll receive a set for as low as $49.99. Go to MyPillow.com, click on the radio listener's square, and use promo code Dobbs. There you'll find not only Mike's amazing offer, but also deep discounts on all MyPillow products, including the MyPillow mattress topper and so much more. Call 1-800-977-9152. Use the promo code Dobbs. Go to MyPillow.com. Make sure you use the promo code Dobbs.
A coalition of food delivery apps, including Grubhub, Uber Eats, DoorDash, and others, have gone to U.S. District Court to sue New York City over its anti-free market law that permanently caps commissions the food delivery services can charge to restaurants. The apps allege the city's regulations hinder their private businesses in an arbitrary and damaging manner. Inflation at the wholesale level surged last month, climbing to over 8%, the biggest annual gain since the Labor Department started tracking the 12-month number back in 2010. The government trying to get to the bottom of missing refunds due to thousands of airline passengers whose flights were canceled in the early days of the China virus pandemic. Please join me three times each weekday for my updates from the Salem Radio Network, right here on this station. This is the Lou Dobbs Financial Report.
AM 560, The Answer.
Dan and Amy, we're back with Dr. Alan Moy from the Vice President of John Paul II Research Institute. He's a pulmonologist by trade. And Dr. Moy, before we got cut off there, I asked the question about this these cases and the data out of England between the age of 40 and the age of 80 during a three-week period in August. They found the infection rates were higher in four of those age cohorts, 40 to 80, all four, higher for the vaccinated, two jabs, than the unvaccinated. What's going on there?
So you're probably having a mixture of a lot of different things going on, one of which is that for the people who are vaccinated, probably early in the year, the vaccine antibodies are waning after 6 months. So those people who were vaccinated early in the year are probably now don't have adequate antibodies. Their T-cell response in certain patients probably is inadequate, and so now they're vulnerable. Or another issue is that those people who are vaccinated may have a false sense of confidence, and they may be doing some things to not protect themselves, and they're getting exposed through just behavioral issues. And then the other is that dependent upon if they were vaccinated more recently, they're experiencing antibody development enhancement. So you have probably a mixture of all those three things going on.
There's a French infectious disease expert named Christian Perron. He used to write the vaccine policy for France. He was the infectious disease guy for the University of Versailles since 1994, until he ran afoul of COVID orthodoxy there in Paris, and he got shunted aside. In an interview, he said, these aren't vaccines. He said, I'm not anti-vaccine because I wrote the vaccination policy for France for a great many years. But the problem is that the products they call vaccines for COVID-19 are not really vaccines. That's my problem. Maybe genetic modifiers. I don't exactly know the proper term from a scientific point of view. But when you inject messenger RNA to produce a huge amount of a spike protein, a fragment of the SARS-CoV-2 virus, you can't control the process. And the problem is that in human cells, we know that RNA might go back to DNA. How do you respond to those observations?
Well, the risk of reversion to DNA does exist. Hard to quantify, probably very low. I think the problem more so is that it's not that. It's the fact is that when you inject that vaccine into the muscle, it doesn't stay there. The majority of it actually leaks out and gets distributed into other organs, which was shown in the animal studies as a requirement for the Japanese regulatory agency. What they found is that the majority of that, when injected in the animal studies, it was going into other organs, the liver and the spleen, which would be expected, but it also can concentrate in the ovaries and into a smaller extent into the testes. So the problem is that there is very unknown effects of this type of vaccine that have never been fully vetted out. And so you have also the mRNA converting into protein, which is the ultimate goal. And that protein actually gets leaked into the circulation.
And in some certain circumstances, I'm sure probably pretty rare, that free spike protein activates the vascular cells. And that's what causes this bleeding and thrombosis clot formation that people are seeing. And it's causing spike protein to being expressed in unintended organs like the heart. And the spike protein is causing inflammation. And so the body doesn't distinguish between tissues that are expressing the spike protein and an infection. So that's why you get some of these autoimmune observations like myocarditis in these young kids.
So is it still your position that that whether it's 18 and under or we're waiting for FDA approval of the Pfizer vaccine for under 12, 5 to 12, 5 to 11, is it your position that those vaccine mandates are misguided, unnecessary?
Yes, and I have always said that anybody who is 30 and under who is healthy, who doesn't have any risk factors, shouldn't be vaccinated. And the people who are high risk, the elderly and people who are young with significant high risk comorbidities should be considered for a vaccine. And that people who are high risk, who are developing COVID should be treated with early treatment for COVID instead of the way we're doing it now.
Did you get vaccinated?
I've never been vaccinated. I refuse to get vaccinated. The problem is that I'm not in that risk factor, those risk categories. And if you look at who are the people who are have the most health vaccine hesitancy, it's the PhDs.
Yeah,
yep.
and a lot of
nurses. That's why some are quitting because of the vaccine mandate.
Yeah, and you also have the good fortune to work at the John Paul II Research Institute, so that helps too. He is Dr. Alan Moy. He's a pulmonologist, and I just mentioned Vice President John Paul II Research Institute. Dr. Moy, thanks as always. Appreciate it.
You're welcome.
He joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Last week on Fox News, in response to the damage and the loss of life inflicted by Hurricane Ida, FEMA Administrator Deanne Criswell told Chris Wallace this.
And we're also seeing, as this storm and some of the other weather events that we've seen, they're just intensifying very rapidly and dropping a large amount of rain and tornadoes. This is the crisis of our generation, these impacts that we're seeing from climate change. And we have to act now to try to protect against the future risks that we're going to face.
And no pushback at all.
And no pushback, that's for sure. And then when President Biden surveyed the Northeast, he polluted the atmosphere with the same hot air.
Mean it. Sometimes my mother used to say, out of everything bad, something good will come if you look hard enough for it. Well, I think we've all seen, even the climate skeptics are seeing, that this really does matter. And it's not just whether or not people who are just trying to get by in these homes, in these alleys here, working their butts off, do well. It's people in high towers along the shore who find that as this rain and all this change takes place in the groundwater, the buildings are actually beginning to tilt. 100-story buildings. This goes so far beyond what anybody's willing to speak to up to now.
Mm-hmm. Well, to speak to that, he's willing to speak to it. Bjorn Lundberg joins us again. He's the president of the Copenhagen Consensus Think Tank, author of False Alarm, How Climate Change Panic Costs Us Trillions, Hurts the Poor, and Fails to Fix the Planet. Bjorn, thanks for being with us again. Appreciate it.
Hey, Dan. It's great to be here.
So how do you respond to our president and FEMA administrator?
Look, global warming is a real problem, but this idea of blaming everything on global warming and failing to see this in context is actually not very helpful. So if you look at the number of hurricanes that hit the U.S., And this is the most well-documented numbers. Since 1900, they have not been increasing. Actually, they've been slightly decreasing. Likewise, with strong hurricanes. So when you see a hurricane, obviously it's a terrible incident, but you have to recognize that it's not getting more frequent. If anything, it's actually getting slightly less frequent. And the same thing goes when you look at flooding in the U.S. We actually have very good data for flooding back to 1903. And again, flooding's impact on the U.S. economy has actually declined about tenfold, whereas numbers of people killed has decreased threefold. It is not an escalating problem that's getting worse and worse. It's a problem that's getting less and less problematic.
Well, isn't
this
the
does not mean that it's not a problem, but it means we need to see this in context.
Well, is the problem, could it be the mainstream media? Because they need these catastrophic events to get people to keep watching the cable news networks.
Well, of course, we've always had this problem that, you know, you see all the bad stuff that's happening in the world, and the natural inclination is to say, oh, then things must be getting worse and worse. And yes, there is some people who definitely want to feed that story. But the truth is, this is all about the CNN effect, that we now have cameras everywhere that shows every problem that happens. And look, these are all real challenges for real people. But the problems have become smaller, not bigger, and we need to understand that. Again, it doesn't mean that global warming is not a problem, but it means we need to understand that when we see damages, when we see people killed either from hurricanes or from flooding, we should say, yes, that's a problem, but it's actually a smaller problem. And why? Because a richer society is more resilient, is more and better able to tackle these problems. And that's what really matters. Make sure people are rich, not poor. That's what really keeps most people safe.
The two prongs of the talking point, one you heard and you just responded to, more frequent, not more frequent. The other prong is more intense. The storms are more intense, and that's a result of climate change.
Mm. And again, and that's why I also mentioned, if you actually look at the strong hurricanes, they have not gotten bigger either. They have not gotten more frequent either. But there is indications that there is a high proportion of strong hurricanes from the 1970s, 80s till today. When you hear that argument, you should be very cautious, because the 1970s and 1980s were probably the lowest frequency ever in the last couple of hundred years. So really, most of the 20th century, you saw a very high level of strong hurricanes versus weak hurricanes. Then it dropped in the 70s, and then it rose up to about the same level in the 2000-2010s. So what you're really seeing is just a reversion to what it used to be. So again, there's some theoretical argument that by, you know, the end of the century, we will have fewer but stronger hurricanes, and that will be a problem from climate change. But it will be nothing compared to the impact of us being much richer and much better able to tackle these problems. That's why these studies also show that even in 2100, with climate change, we will be better protected. There will be a lower number of people dying, and there will be even lower impacts in terms of percent of GDP.
With respect to the modeling and the projections out to 50 and 100 years, one, how reliable those are. But even directionally, I note the very little coverage this got, which is the UN's IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, reduced their projection in terms of how much the Earth will warm between now and 2100 in its most recent report. And So what's happening there? They don't seem to be following the alarmist script.
Mm. So they narrowed the band that we think is the likely outcome. So they both increased the lower band and decreased the high band. And so you're right. We should be pleased that we're more certain we're not going to see very, very large scale and very damaging global warming impact. But honestly, this is more for, you know, the scientists. Sure, this is an important issue, but the main impact is, of course, what is this going to do for your societies? And the thing that I think we almost always forget to realize is it's not just about how strong the storm is or how much water that drops in 24 hours. It's about how resilient is your society. And what we have done is, over the last 120 years, we've taken poor societies to become rich societies that are phenomenally more resilient. We need to do the same thing for the rest of the world. Remember, a hurricane hitting Florida, yes, it makes a lot of damage, but it doesn't kill all that many people. Whereas if the same sort of hurricane hits, for instance, Guatemala, it'll wipe down their GDP, and it will kill tens of thousands of people. So the reality here is, again, instead of trying to say we need to cut a ton of CO2, which, yes, will do a little good at very high cost, we should be focusing on making sure that people get out of poverty, out of their corrugated roofs, out of their slum cities, which is where you're really vulnerable to many of the natural catastrophes, and get them into safe housing, into industrialized and resilient societies that can actually tackle these issues.
Well, right. And this is one of the points that you always make, and which is why I appreciate your work so much, because you live in the real world of trade-offs, and some of these policymakers and politicians don't, or at least they pretend not to. And so one of the arguments that you've made in your work is, well, look at also over the course of, say, the last 100 years in America, how much better engineered our infrastructure is, the housing stock and so forth. And that matters, too. And it matters in America, and it matters around the world. So before you start, you know, cutting off reliable energy sources to the underdeveloped world, you know, consider the damage you're going to do in the short and medium term in terms of cost of human life that could be avoided if you, again, help them grow rich like America and so many countries in the West have.
And exactly. You know, one of the things that blow my mind is people worry a lot about heat death. They should also worry enormously about cold deaths. They vastly outweigh heat deaths almost everywhere in the world. But the way you fix heat and cold deaths is by having access to cheap and reliable energy so that you can keep warm or keep cool. It's not predominantly about cutting carbon emissions, but it's about making sure that you have cheap and reliable energy. Unfortunately, most people in this space are arguing for the exact opposite. They're saying, We're facing a climate catastrophe, so we got to make cheap and reliable energy unreliable but very expensive. That's not a solution.
Yeah, it seems to me, right? You tackle this question differently. You know, can we get to zero carbon emissions by 2035? Most serious energy analysts will tell you no, not if we want to enjoy the standard of living we enjoy at present, much less what we could enjoy, you know, a decade plus from now. But you take the position we shouldn't even be trying. I mean, yes, you reduce carbon emissions through technological innovation has happened across industries, including fossil fuels. But that's not the goal. The goal is to have people around the world and even within the United States in poor areas enjoy the same benefits of technological innovation that the wealthy areas in the United States enjoy.
So certainly we should first go for making sure that all the poor people also have access to cheap and reliable energy. In the long run, we should also go for innovation, but we should also recognize that you are not going to get reelected neither as a Republican but nor as a Democrat if you try to make energy so expensive, people can't afford it. We've seen that happen, and you know that was several years of riots in France when you just tried to you know, increase a gallon of gasoline by about 10 cents. You know, people don't want you to do that.
I wonder if, you know, your work, the work of Michael Schellenberger, who's, you know, been an environmentalist for 30 years, and he wrote that infamous mea culpa last year that was, of course, immediately ignored by, you know, most in these circles about, you know, his contribution in his own words and his own assessment to creating panic rather than intelligent public policy. I wonder if, you know, the work of yours and Schellenberger's and other scientists who live in this real world of trade-offs and priorities, is it gaining any ground with those who have been sort of climate change zealots and dominated some of the discussion to this point over the last, say, 20 or 30 years?
Oh, Dan, it's hard to say, because if you look at the world, it seems like a lot of people are just running around with their, you know, like chickens without their head. And it really feels like a lot of people have just gone silly. On the other hand, if you look at what nations are actually doing, and perhaps particularly developing nations like China and India, who have a responsibility to pull their populations out of poverty, they are pretty much behaving as you'd imagine real and rational politicians would be doing. So there is a lot of words on one side and a lot of panic. And of course, that scares our kids witless. But the reality is that we're moving slightly towards a cleaner world, which is great. But we're not at any way moving in the direction of just a net zero world in the next 10, 20, even 30 years, which would probably also be phenomenally expensive and actually lead to most of these politicians being booted up by dissatisfied voters. So in some sense, the rationality is winning, but it's not winning the chatterbox contest, right, of the elite.
Right. They're rich enough to be able to afford having these ridiculous opinions. No, I get that. We see that across a lot of issues. He is Bjorn Lundberg, president of the Copenhagen Consensus Think Tank, author of False Alarm, How Climate Change Panic costs us Trillions, Hurts the Poor, and Fails to Fix the Planet. Bjorn Lundberg, thanks as always. Appreciate it.
Hey, great to talk to you guys.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. Listen to AM 560, The Answer, online at 560theanswer.com, on the AM 560 mobile app, on your Alexa-powered smart speaker, and on TuneIn, iHeart, and on Odyssey.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. The story of Scott Grigoletto, not to be confused with the father of Gilda in the Verdi opera, Rigoletto. This is Scott Grigoletto.
Yes, we're very familiar with his work.
Yeah, he's the little drummer boy, music teacher at Glenbard North, who had this to say, caught on video with addressing a student who was not wearing a mask over his nose in school.
You're playing? Are you playing? No, I'm not. Otherwise, I will call the police. Oh. I'm serious.
Okay,
yeah, can
you? Are you serious?
Yeah, I am serious, man. I am had enough of it. I knew you were going to take off your mask the moment I turned the corner. So enjoy BIA. That's a in-school suspension where you have to sit in the room with the military guy all day because you're a piece of
He wrote in his resignation letter, "I would like to apologize to all of you and express my regret over my actions and words last week. As an educator, part of my job is serving as a role model to my students, and in that moment I fell short. Every day I was inspired by every single one of you, except the piece of crap. And I will keep all of your words and kindness in my heart on my journey of self-improvement to become a better human being. That is a journey I doubt will find a destination." Scott Grigoletto, 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer, answer line, 64636DA, turnkey.pro text line. Why is Scott Grigoletto gone? There's only one reason.
What, because he got caught?
How did he get caught?
Because the student was, the guy's friend was recording it.
Bingo. That's the only reason. Yep. The District 87, which has tolerated Scott Grigoletto to this point, this is the only reason that he's gone, is because it was caught on video and it made its way to the public arena. If this had been, that kid and his friend,
yep,
describing what occurred.
Bingo.
And Grigoletto denying it or even admitting it, he wouldn't be gone.
No.
I guarantee you.
It's the fact that it got millions of views on all across the world. And that's the reason why. And I called that school and I called their PR person too. They were so smug on the phone. Like, well, what do you want? I said, well, is Scott Grigoletto there? Or is he still teaching there? Is he on leave? Like, well, who's calling? They're so defensive of him. They're acting like he was a hero. You know,
he's busy banging on his drum all day.
Yeah, you know, because he stopped a kid who had a mask under his nose while he's yelling at the kid with his mask under his nose. He was wearing the mask wrong.
Yeah.
And it's so wrong on a number of levels because people are so psychotic right now about these masks that if they knew the truth, they might calm down and live longer because it's going to add stress to their lives and years off their life.
Well, look, I'm no fan of surveillance culture, but it seems to me that if you want to affect a change in culture at these indoctrination camps they call government K through 12 schools, then you have to, you know, wire up the schools and maybe the teachers. I don't know, maybe the kids too. Wire everybody up, because the only way you get anything approximating accountability for bad conduct by the adults is to capture it. Otherwise, yeah, parents are either ignorant of it or indifferent to it or some combination of the two. And it becomes, you know, people's words against people's words. And these are all fellow travelers that are going to back each other's play just up until the point that it becomes too politically expensive to do so, which is why Scott Grigoletto decided to take the stairs rather than be defenestrated.
Yeah, well, he's going to get a job. I'm sorry for interrupting, but he's going to get a job somewhere else. He may take a month off.
Dance of the Lemons. Pay attention to where he lands.
That's true. I'm glad he wrote a letter, conceding that what he did was wrong. At least that's a start. But, you know, he's going to, because what he did was celebrated by other teachers there. It's ridiculous. And he's going to get a job somewhere else. And yes, we do need to pay attention and hold him accountable if he does that again, because that's not his first time. He said that with the ease of walking down the hallway.
Obviously, this is so much bigger than that little drummer boy at Glenbard North. And you see these fights playing out on multiple fronts. This war is being, you know, there are battles within this war. Identitarian battles, critical race theory in the curriculum, mm-hmm. LGBTQ in the curriculum, and then COVID. All of these are battles that are being waged, at least they're being waged in some places, by some parents in defense of and furtherance of some kids' education. But I don't see a lot of winning. One place where there may be some additional winning is Loudoun County, Virginia. I mean, we keep going back to that. You know why we keep going back to it? Because the parents there have decided to make it a pitch battle on all fronts. And I don't think there's many other school districts where you can say that. All fronts. CRT, LGBTQ, COVID. They've got all the acronyms. They've got all the acronyms in their crosshairs. So, for example, a parents group just made a $500,000 ad buy going after their betters in the school district that they can't otherwise de-elect at the moment, recall at the moment. Here's the ad that they posted called Silence.
Loudoun County, Virginia spent nearly $500,000 to develop a divisive curriculum promoted by political activists. When parents spoke up, officials threatened to silence them. Then a teacher was put on leave for his religious beliefs. Others encouraged to turn in colleagues. And now powerful education unions are using dirty political campaign tactics to go after parents. Suppression, political activism, censorship. Let's get politics out of the classroom. Join us.
Wow, good for
turning
that.
The screws on the administrators, the teachers union, and the school board members in Loudoun County. And that's exactly what's required. Ian Pryor, who we've had on the show before, is a parent in Loudoun County. He's a former DOJ lawyer as well. He was on Fox News over the weekend talking about the pronoun piece and the LGBTQ strictures in the Loudoun County schools, as you heard referenced in that ad. Tanner Cross, the gym teacher there, who was put on leave for being unwilling to call kids by their preferred pronoun, but rather by pronouns reflective of their biological sex. It was his religious belief that informed that decision, and he serves God before he serves the Loudoun County Marxists. And this is what Ian Pryor had to say as it pertains to that front in the war.
Let's pop up the policy on the screen for the viewer. Staff must use students' preferred pronouns and undergo LGBTQ+ training. Trans students can play sports corresponding to gender identity. Trans students can use bathrooms corresponding to gender identity. In the first minute and a half of this segment, Ian, we've both referenced the parents and the school board. Parents and school board, I have a question. What do the kids think about this? Because ultimately, at the end of the day, education's about the kids, right?
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, the parents that are speaking, they're speaking for their kids. I mean, there are plenty of, you know, girls, teenagers, middle schoolers that are not comfortable sharing bathrooms in this way. You know, it's interesting because in the regulation, they talk about overnight field trips. So in the overnight field trips, you know, a biological boy would be able to stay in a room with girls. Now, you cannot separate that biological boy into a separate room. But if a girl feels uncomfortable in that situation, guess what? That girl then has to go stay in a separate room by herself. This is exactly what we're talking about. You're creating an accommodation, and then for the people that, you know, that have issues with it, you are now making it difficult for them and then impacting their rights. There are ways to do this where you can respect people's First Amendment rights. Right. And I think parents were pleading with the school board to, hey, slow this down. Let's figure out a way that you could do this while not impacting our rights and our children's rights and the right to, you know, make parental choices. Right. But the school board, other than two individuals, just didn't want to hear it.
Mm-hmm. The school board didn't want to hear it. And, you know, this prompts a question we've visited before many times, but I think it demands revisiting. Where are the men? Where are the fathers? We've seen some in Loudoun County.
Yeah.
I've seen fewer elsewhere in school districts that we've covered. And, you know, nobody pays attention to what I have to say. I'm just a local yokel. Maybe a Tucker Carlson, who's important because he has a show on Fox. Maybe what he has to say. He recently gave an interview with Glenn Beck, to Glenn Beck. And this is what he had to say about men and women today, particularly men. And since he's echoing things I've been saying for years, I'm in complete agreement. Take a listen.
And there are a lot of them like this. Roger Wicker of Mississippi, I think he's probably a good guy. They're weak. There's something in them that's weak, and they've decided, I'm not, you know, the other side is ascendant, the left is winning, I'm not going to push any buttons that, you know, might infuriate them. They're just, they're not lion-hearted. And this is a moment when you need people who aren't, you know, vicious, lashing out, crazy, that I hate that, but who are legitimately strong. Will say, here are my principles, I will clearly articulate them for you, and by the way, I'll die for them. Because that's what principles are, you know, real principles, not BS, you know, this is the tax rate I want. But like, people should be allowed to say what they really believe. That's called freedom of speech. It's guaranteed in the First Amendment to the Bill of Rights. That's a non-negotiable point, period. Someone who will do that. And they're like, none of them. The only ones who will do it are women. And that has a lot of consequences. For one thing, it drives the women crazy. A lot of really angry women right now, have you noticed? And I think a lot of them are angry because their men are weak. I do think that. I mean, I don't think that. I know that. And I've been married to the same woman for 30 years. And if you want to make her mad, you know, weak men, this is true for a lot of, I have three daughters. I see this all the time. Weak men make them mad because it's wrong. And this is like basic and human. You know, all the true basic human things are the things we're not allowed to talk about.
Yeah,
you know,
right.
We can like talk right about our dumb theories, but the way that people really are, nature itself is so offensive to our leaders because it challenges their totally unnatural program. There's nothing less natural than neoliberalism. It's an assault on nature. It's a denial of nature.
Yep.
But at its core, nature is about sex differences. Men and women are different. Does and stags are different. Their difference is the central fact of the natural world. And if something falls out of balance in that relationship between male and female, everything else is affected by it. Everything.
That's true. If you're not going to fight for your wife and children, you're not going to fight for your country. You're not going to fight for anything. You're a wuss.
Women
have been doing the heavy lifting for a long time.
The reason that so many women are angry is because their men are weak. That certainly explains most of the suburbs around Chicago. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 646-36DA, turnkey.pro text line. You find retiring men who, you know, don't have the time or inclination or lion-heartedness, as Tucker said, to take up these fights. On all these battlefronts, you find them laudable. You find them sensible. It's not worth it.
That's why we're labeled the B word a lot of times.
The fundamental fact of the natural world, the difference between men and women. And if you don't get the fundamental facts right, or you pretend that you can just ignore them, or you bend nature, the natural world, to your will, then what you see are the results playing out at the school district level and in so many other arenas, isn't it?
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment.
Greg in Jefferson Park.
Hey, good morning, guys. A couple things. You know, with respect to, and I agree 100%, every teacher ought to be videotaped every day for every school in the country. And as soon as, people start finding more of these lunatics, and there's no doubt tens of thousands of them, they'll start outlawing it. You know, they'll outlaw people, videotaping what's going on in the class. And as far as, this men, yeah, men have dropped the ball on a lot of things and aren't stepping up to the plate. But you know what? I don't know. I just don't see anything good happen. You know, we got three women basically running this city, and look what it's turned into. It's gone from worse, from where we had Rombo and Daley before that, to catastrophic, basically. Anyways, you guys have a good one.
Thanks for the call, Greg. Well, those weren't men either. Those were male impersonators, those tiny little
dancers.
Democrat socialists. Yeah.
Why are they all so short?
Terry in Rogers Park, do you like male impersonators? Do you like weak men?
I sure don't. I don't like those buns on top of their heads these days.
I know. It's called the man
Rogers.
Bun.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, it's sickening. I like a real man. And so do so do other women.
Yeah.
Thanks for the call, Terry. Paula and Racine.
Yep. So I think a lot of men always see, and the battle, is most prominent right now in the schools. And I think a lot of men see school the purview of the mother, right? And
yeah.
So I think they're hesitant to step in, for fear of being labeled, I guess something maybe less than manly.
Well, that's thanks for the call, Paula, but it's just the opposite, isn't it? And, Tucker mentioned Roger Wicker at the outset, talking about, weak Republicans. Roger Wicker is a Republican senator from Mississippi, United States senator. What about the weak men who won't take up the fight when their job is to take up the fight, like as a political office holder? I mean, forget the, this is really the purview. Conservative circles, yes, there are some exceptions that we can name, Rand Paul and others that have taken up fights, Ted Cruz, obviously Trump. But by and large, I mean, in conservative circles and Republican circles in Illinois, it's nothing but eunuchs. Nothing but eunuchs. What fights have they taken up? What fights? It's your kid, too, in that school. It's your kid, too, in that business. What high-profile fights can you recall? What come to mind? Like legitimate, intellectual, civilizational fights have you seen people take up? Tanner Cross, the gym teacher in Loudoun County, was that weak of him to say, I'm not going to abide this because I serve God first, and I love my kids, but I'm not going to participate in a lie? Was that a moment of weakness or strength? So for men who say, well, this isn't my arena because schools are for women, what? They're male teachers. They're male administrators. They're male school board members. They're absolved? No, that's a cop-out for their pusillanimous hearts. Joe in Tinley Park.
Yeah, back in my Democrat day, I was watching Phil Donahue's show in 1979, and he had Ayn Rand on, and he asked her, what is the biggest threat to the United States? She said, our universities. And him and the audience laughed at her.
Mm-hmm.
She was so right.
Okay, thanks for the call. There's a lot of male university professors.
Oh, yes.
University presidents. Go to that World Business Chicago ad that we mentioned at the bottom of the hour, the cheap political ploy that Lightfoot imposed on World Business Chicago. And all those Fortune 500 CEOs on that list who participated in the, you know, what we have to offer as leftist politics to Dallas businesses to come to Chicago. Where are the men in corporate boardrooms? Oh, the men dominate this and the men dominate that. So they essentially internalize who these harridans and other male impersonators on the left say they are, and then they live down to that description.
Well, they act like they're, you know, wannabe feminists. Oh, I support women, but will you protect women? Will you protect your children and show up at school board meetings to defend their freedoms for education? No.
Vince in St. Charles.
Morning, guys. Yeah, that's why a lot of the guys I still work with are Democrats, because their wives tell them what to do and they share their brain and their money. So they're Democrats still because they can't think by themselves.
Yeah. Well, and they're not men. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
You've made the switch, and it feels so good. You've switched to Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
From the Matrix Home Solutions Studios, this is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Listen to AM 560 The Answer online at 560theanswer.com, on the AM 560 mobile app, on your Alexa-powered smart speaker, and on TuneIn, iHeart, and on Odyssey. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560 The Answer.
Nice, Paula Cole. Dan and Amy, good morning. Following up on our discussion about weak men at the end of last hour. And I'll tell you what, I think we should fold Dave Seminara, our next guest, into this conversation. We got a lot to talk with him about, but I want to get his perspective. He's a raconteur. He is a bon vivant. He is a globetrotter. He may have something to say about this. Dave Seminara is also a former diplomat and the author of Footsteps of Federer and Mad Travelers, A Tale of Wanderlust, Greed, and the Quest to Reach the Ends of the Earth. Dave, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Hey, thanks, Dan. And I liked all of that introduction except for the bon vivant part. I don't want to be a bon vivant.
All right. It's too effeminate. Is that it? Yeah.
Yes.
So we were talking at the last hour about these fights at the school board level on all fronts, COVID, CRT, other identitarian political battles, like over pronoun usage. And it's all the women doing the fighting. And it's a conversation we've had on the show before, but Tucker Carlson also weighed in on this in an interview he gave to Glenn Beck, talking about how, we just have so many weak men. And so you don't see men as material in these battles over really civilizational issues like K-12 education. And there are so many angry women, Tucker Carlson argues, because there are so many weak men in their lives. And I wanted you to weigh in on that about weak men and angry women, and the fact, that Tucker said, and I agree, this is a fact. If you get this fundamental truth of the natural world wrong, there's a difference between men and women, then you unleash all sorts of horribles.
Well, you know, I usually watch Tucker every day, except there was an exception for the last 2 weeks because the U.S. Open tennis was on. So I actually missed that, although Tucker is usually must-watch television, but I missed that. But that's sort of an interesting theory. I don't know. Weak men. I mean, we're being told to be quiet about a lot of different issues, aren't we? Like, God forbid if, for example, the abortion issue. I think there was a reporter who asked Jemski a question about abortion. And didn't she basically tell him, well, how dare you even speak? Because
yeah, you don't know what it's like to be pregnant.
About things like this.
Yep.
Yeah. So I think, you know, on some issues we're actively being told to be quiet, especially abortion. Like, how dare you have an opinion about that? And I think regarding the school board, you know, issues and stuff like that, I have to say, I mean, women are more involved with their children's education to begin with. I think a lot of men, I don't know if it's from weakness or lack of interest, are not very involved in what their kids are doing. They're not the ones who are helping them with their homework. They're not the ones going to the school board meetings, and they're sort of detached and uninvolved. But I don't know if that's because of weakness or what it is. What do you think? What's your theory?
Well, they've never been needed more to be involved than right now. This is when they need to step up. Mm-hmm. This is when we need them mm-hmm. to help. And instead, mm-hmm. you know, in our neighborhood, they're, and the men are just masking up and doing the half moon around people, and the men are the ones that are masked up and not the women. It's the strangest thing.
Well, there's two things too, Dave. One is, just because someone is tells you that you're not allowed to speak doesn't mean you have to abide their directive. Number two, as I was mentioning last hour, there are men on the school boards. There are men in, as teachers. There are men as administrators. So they have a material day-to-day involvement in the school boards, and yet we don't hear from them either, except to the extent they're folded in with the left orthodoxy. So I think it's more than just, you know, dad's too busy at work to go to a school board meeting. There's something cultural happening that has happened.
That could be. I mean, I'll tell you, from my part, you know, regarding the masking issue, I tried to get involved. My kids are in Catholic schools here in Florida. We used to, they started out kindergarten. We were in Illinois, and we actually lived in River Forest and then at Evanston. So we've been in Catholic schools there. Now we're out in Florida. And the Catholic schools here, I thought was going to be a different picture. I mean, the media pictures Florida as this really free place, and it is to a degree. However, our kids were required to wear masks too. Like, they told us over the summer that the kids were not going to have to wear masks. And I thought, oh, thank God, finally the kids are going to be free this school year, you know? But literally 2 days into the school year, they changed the policy and they said, no, now they are going to have to be masked. And I sent an email to the superintendent of schools for the diocese here and said, well, what about vaccinated children? Because my older son is actually old enough to be vaccinated. He's an eighth grader. He's already been vaccinated. Why do vaccinated children have to wear a mask all day long in school? And I got back such a bizarre reply. I got this bizarre reply where the guy sent back all kinds of links to studies about the efficacy of masks. And I said, that really wasn't what I asked you. I asked about, why do vaccinated children have to wear masks all day long? And I never got another reply. So I tried to get a little bit involved here. But a lot of times, I think in a case too, where you've got a husband and wife, they don't agree on the issue. To be honest with you, my wife, you know, is fine with the kids wearing masks all day long. Her attitude is, well, you know, why not err on the side of caution? So I think in a lot of cases, a lot of marriages, maybe the husband and the wife don't agree on it, so the husband is taking a back seat. Could that be?
Well, that's clearly going on. There's no question about it. But I'd love to see, by the way, the links to those studies that reportedly approve mask efficacy. But also, you also have the governor issuing a statewide ban on mask mandates that's been upheld, at least for now, by the first district appellate court. So a lot of these schools, you know, you have the governor that has your back in the state of Florida. And so it seems to me an opportunity to prosecute the case.
Yeah, no, it could be. I don't know what's going to happen here with that, to be honest with you. I think that our kids are going to be masked here for a very long time, because the metrics they sent us was that it had to be something like fewer than 100 cases per 100,000 in the population. At the time here in Florida, we were like 600. And I thought, really, when are we going to get to, and it had to be test positive of less than 10%. I thought, really? I mean, my kids, they just joined this school like 2 years ago. Are they going to, and my one kid is in eighth grade, is he going to graduate from the school never having seen like anyone's face, any of his teachers' faces? Is he going to graduate from the school without ever having seen one of his friends like smile in the class? Of course, he sees them outside smiling and stuff like that. But I mean, really? It's just, when does it end? I don't know.
I'll tell you what, Dave, since I care more about Florida than I do Illinois, because Florida cares more about itself than Illinois cares about itself, I'll take up this, and especially because it's a Catholic school, just leave the school name with our producer there, and I'll take up that fight. We'll go talk to the Catholic school. I'm happy to do that.
All right. Thank you.
All right. I want to get to some of the other things that you've written recently, including a call for to rethink the 5-day work week, to go to a 4-day work week, so that you have more time to travel the globe.
No, it's not just that. Think about it. When do you spend your money? I think this would be tremendous for the economy, a few different reasons. You spend your money when you have time off, right? Think about it. Look at your credit card bills. When are you going out to eat? You know, when are you buying stuff? When are you shopping? It's when you've got free time. I mean, first of all, you have to think about the biggest industry in the country that employs the most people is the travel industry. It's estimated that about 10% of Americans are either directly employed in the travel industry or they work in a related business that benefits from the travel industry. So, I mean, first of all, 4-day week work would be incredible for the travel industry. It would be great for, think about restaurants, how badly restaurants have struggled over the last year or two. It would be great for restaurants. bars, a lot of other businesses. So first of all, I think it would stimulate spending in the economy, which for some people who are already in debt and have big credit card bills, maybe it wouldn't be so great, but I think it'd be great for the economy, for one thing. Secondly, you hear this from employers all over the country. You've got this movement, it's called the Great Resignation. There's been some studies that have shown that something like 40 or 50% of Americans are looking for other jobs, and an unprecedented number of Americans have quit their jobs in the last year. So companies are struggling to hire and recruit, and I think what better way? I mean, I'm not a person for a government mandate, as I said in my article. I believe in a free market sort of approach to this. I'm not saying the government should insist upon four-day work weeks or anything like that. But I think for companies that are struggling to recruit, offering people the option of the four-day work week, hey, you want to work four longer days? Believe me, you're going to get more applications. I think it's an effective recruiting tool, I think. What do you guys think?
Well, you read in your article in the Washington Examiner that 65 years ago, President Richard Nixon brought this up. Why are we still sitting on our hands on this one?
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's something I think at the very least we should be striving toward. I mean, I think, you know, in terms of looking at quality of life and prosperity, we should be seeking to get to a point where we're working less hours, shouldn't we? I mean, shouldn't that be the goal? I don't think, and I think a lot of people have this attitude of, oh, you work really long, you want to put in hours because it makes it seem like you're more hardworking. Well, not necessarily. You're not necessarily more effective because you spent more time at the office. The guy who stays the latest isn't necessarily the most effective, right?
Yeah, no, that's right. I mean, it's right, smarter, not necessarily longer, not necessarily, although some things are, you know, labor hour intensive. But I appreciate what you're saying in terms of at least rethinking it. And you know, I mean, I'd love to have Eric in the mornings schedule Amy. I'm sure Amy would too. You know, we take Fridays off, and you know, that's one day where
we could travel.
Yes, they just have, you know, some interns spin Maroon 5 records instead of Eric. I wanted to also get to this too. I mean, especially against the backdrop of Afghan refugees that have been brought to this country and Afghan allies that are. Hopefully all of our allies there get out and get to this country, those that are deserving of that for aiding and abetting the U.S. military while we were present in Afghanistan. But you talk about sort of in the era of COVID, how Americans are treated to COVID protocols that are much more stringent than people coming from foreign countries, particularly coming from foreign countries that are, you know, much further behind in terms of all of these mitigation efforts, starting with vaccinations, sure, than America's.
Yeah, no, I mean, I haven't looked at this recently, but as of a couple of weeks ago, Guatemala had something like a 5 or 6% vaccination rate, right? And yet it's interesting how the left is not concerned about this at all, right? They're so concerned about us here in Florida. They're so concerned about the low vaccination rate in, you know, Mississippi. But hey, let's not worry at all about Honduras or Guatemala or all of these countries in Central America who have, you know, unbelievably low vaccination rates and having migrants come in and in many cases not be tested across the border. It's interesting how they're not concerned about that COVID threat, are they?
Well, right. And it also, right. So it said something about both things, about their priorities when it comes to open borders. It also says something perhaps about their real belief as to how much of a threat that COVID poses to the general younger, non-comorbid suffering population.
Yeah, no, unvaccinated Americans they consider to be a huge threat, but unvaccinated migrants coming from Mexico and Central America, no problem. And why are we, the point I tried to get around in the article is I think I've spent like $500 on COVID testing this year as someone who travels internationally with my family. I mean, why do Americans have to be tested on the way back in the border? Our last trip to Ecuador, my 11-year-old had to be tested 3 times total on the trip, and every time it's $40-$50. So we had to be tested once to get into Ecuador, another time to get into the Galapagos, and then once to get back into the U.S. So 3 COVID tests within a period of 2 weeks he had.
We had to drive to Kenosha to get tested to go to Hawaii because I only take a certain type of test. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's ridiculous.
And so why do Americans have to be tested on the way back in? However, Border Patrol, Customs and Border Patrol, we're relying upon charities and NGOs and other groups, non-governmental groups and local governments, to test migrants coming in. And in some cases, they're not being tested at all. So my point is, if you want to come to the U.S. and claim asylum, shouldn't we require a COVID test on the way in? We're not. You can come in without a COVID test, but Americans can't. Why not have some consistency there?
Yeah, well, they can get away with it because, you know, who gets into the details of this except for people like you? And oh, by the way, just in terms of Florida and vaccinations, too, Florida's a real problem in terms of the vaccination level. It's it would shock most of the nation to learn that Florida has a higher percentage of its population vaccinated than does Illinois.
Yes, and thank you so much for pointing that out. And also states like Michigan, where Gretchen Whitmer has been ruling with an iron hand. At the last time I looked, their vaccination rate was 6 or 7 points lower than ours. I mean, can you imagine? Would the media ever report that? No.
And the COVID numbers in Florida and in Los Angeles, they're going down right now. So that's a good thing. And no one's reporting that either.
No, and you mentioned Hawaii also, Amy. I mean, Hawaii has the highest vaccination rate in the country. And yet they're having quite a surge. Their hospitals are overwhelmed, and now they're scaling. I believe I read they're scaling back tourism. Are they limiting tourism now in Hawaii, aren't they?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. Well, so, Hawaii is like our Australia. They're a biometric security state.
That was, or I should have never have gone. Don't do it.
Dave Seminara, former diplomat, author of Footsteps of Federer and Mad Travelers: A Tale of Wanderlust, Greed, and the Quest to Reach the Ends of the Earth. Dave, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate
it. Thanks, guys. Have a great day. Thank you.
You too.
Thank you. And he joined us on our Turnkey.pro answer line.
Connect with Dan and Amy using the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. AM560, The Answer.
Dan and Amy, Amy, I'm done with the NFL, but I did catch the new Subway spokesman's ad, the new Subway spokesman, Tampa Bay Bucks quarterback Tom Brady.
He's so hot.
Seductive.
Hot.
Irresistible. Yet forbidden. Pretty.
The new fragrance that says Subway has so much new, it didn't fit in their last ad. So they bought time and mind to talk about hearty multigrain bread.
Freshly baked.
Smells so good, I can almost taste it.
But you don't eat bread.
It's the best. You got to see it.
Oh, gosh.
Oh, I know. I'm
ready.
Hot and bothered now.
Yeah, get a hold of yourself over there. My question for the new Subway spokesman.
Yes, sir. Yes.
Do you eat their tuna? In quotation marks?
At 2 in the morning in the wintertime when it's 29 below zero.
Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan and Amy continues now. And make sure to stay tuned to catch me, Mike Gallagher, coming up at 9, only on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. So that California recall election on Gavin Newsom, Mr. French Laundry, is tomorrow. And the public sector unions, realizing Gavin Newsom a few weeks ago was in dire straits, have scrambled a lot of resources to try to put some distance between Gavin Newsom and that 50% plus one threshold that he needs to clear. The betting markets right now have Newsom a 6-1 favorite to avoid recall, to remain in office. So at least according to the polling and the betting markets, the public sector unions have been able to create that distance. And again, we knew this was going to be uphill the entire time because of just the massive disparity between those self-identified Democrat socialists and anybody who, you know, lives with both feet planted on the firm ground in this country.
And Governor Newsom, I mean, he campaigned with Kamala Harris. Today, President Biden, he needs to call out the president. Yeah, I think that might help Larry Elder, who spoke to the media yesterday about people keep tagging him as an anti-vaxxer, and he's not.
I'm not anti-vax. I've been vaccinated. What I'm opposed to are vaccine mandates and face mask mandates.
Yes.
As if the truth mattered.
Right.
As if the truth mattered to the left or to wide swaths of that electorate, unfortunately. One interesting thing, despite what the betting markets and the polls are saying, boy, it would be an additional layer of delight if this mostly mail-in election turned out in favor of, well, recalling Newsom and making Larry Elder the governor, because, you know, mail in, that's one more step that you have to take. And if you don't have a motivated electorate, like, do I really care that much about Gavin Newsom's future with all of the disappointments and how catastrophic the situation in California is with homelessness and crime and COVID lockdowns and by extension the economy? You know, you could have a motivated recall and motivated Elder electorate, perhaps stage of surprise. For more on the topic, we're pleased to be joined by Kurt Mills. He's the contributing editor of the American Conservative. Kurt, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Hey, good morning.
Good morning. So what chance do we have with the black face of white supremacy, as Larry Elder has been termed?
It looks like the chances for Newsom to be ejected are thinning. This race has sort of opened up considerably in recent weeks. That being said, I think we are in something of a new normal in elections generally, which is that basically people's faith in polling is quite wafer thin. And, we really don't know. But it looks like that once this race, and just to be clear to your viewers, the way this works is voters in California get two choices, one, yay or nay on the recall, and then two, even if they vote no on the recall, pick from a list of about 40 candidates. Now, the Democrats and Newsom have urged everybody to not vote for a replacement, to leave that section of the ballot blank. Obviously, that's a controversial strategy and, it complicates the matter. I think since the race broke open between Newsom and Elder as the clear, most likely Republican to replace Newsom, it raises all kinds of interesting questions about the Republican Party's strategy in this race.
Well, there's 10 million registered Democrats in California and only 5 million Republicans. I mean, do they see that, there's 47 or 45 other names on the ballot? Are they all going to back Larry Elder, do you think?
Well, it doesn't really matter because it's whoever is the plurality winner on that second question would become the governor in the event that it was a yes vote.
But even if they vote to maintain Newsom in the office, the nature of this campaign and how Larry Elder has been treated, the racial nature of this campaign, I wonder if that will have lasting impacts, both damaging to Newsom and his national aspirations, and perhaps energizing to Republicans, not just in California, but around the country, and black Republicans at that.
Yeah, I'm not sure what national ambitions Mr. Newsom still has. He's obviously fighting for his political life right now. The fact that his sort of friend and rival, Kamala Harris, is the vice president from that state, I think his pathway to the presidency, if he ever seriously considered it, it's closed, at least for the foreseeable future, assuming he survives his recall. That all being said, I do think the race, like I said, poses interesting questions. The race has become very nationalized, and I assume, in a state as large as California, it's almost unavoidable. But Elder is very much a sort of a national Republican and, further right wing than perhaps a Republican who could win this state. That all being said, the Republicans pick somebody with high name ID, the famous radio host in the state, and he picks someone who's very charismatic and an African-American. One would have thought that the endorsement or all but endorsement that he got from the radio host or the podcast host Joe Rogan would have helped Elder. But I think ultimately the attacks on Elder as too extreme have been quite effective.
It's an opportunity to jujitsu the left. You're talking about a guy who went from South Central Crenshaw High School to get his law degree from Michigan and then obviously have a successful career in business and in the radio, on the radio as well. And to have him followed around by somebody with an ape mask on, to have people calling him the black face of white supremacy. That seems to me something that Larry could leverage and Republicans around the country can leverage as evidence of just how intolerant and barbaric and distasteful the left really is.
Yeah, I mean, look, obviously the excess of this is stuff that can't be defended. I think the LA Times handling of him, sort of his career, his associations with former Trump consigliere Stephen Miller, et cetera, I think they potentially crossed the line. That all being said, Elder did not make great pains to tailor his own policy positions to a state that is clearly more liberal than he is.
Well, I mean, the editor for the LA Times says he poses a threat to communities of color. Give me a break. And if it was anybody else in an ape or a gorilla mask throwing an egg at a black Democrat. Are you kidding me? That would have made the news, but this was hardly picked up, what happened to him when he left that homeless encampment in L.A.
No disagreement. I mean, he's obviously not getting any favors because he's a black Republican. It's interesting. I mean, I think obviously it would have been more dynamic had Elder triumphed. But who knows? If he does win tomorrow, it will be the biggest polling distance Brexit. So everybody thought that was a done deal.
And it will be felt in space. It will be that seismic. But
if they actually pull this off, I argue that it would be the largest Republican victory since Trump won in 2016. Think about it. I mean, what's the bigger electoral win? So, yeah.
Oh, yeah. And you know, I mean, just on the sort of the political strategy perspective, I mean, I think Elder, hewing to who he is, is the right play. He's got to be who he is and who he's been for, you know, seven decades on this planet, number one. Number two, this race should be a referendum on Newsom, and he's obviously, understandably, trying to make it a referendum on Elder, because if it's a referendum on him, he loses. And he's got a lot more firepower, both in terms of money and infrastructure, with the public sector unions. But Elder is, I think, exactly right to continue with his messaging opportunities to put it back on Newsom and to talk about those quality of life issues that bedevil so many Californians, reasonable Californians, middle income Californians, those that are left, like I mentioned at the outset, the crime problem in big cities, the homeless problem in all cities of any size in California, basically, you know, that the state being something akin to a third world country outside of its pockets of wealth.
Yeah, I mean, look, I spent time in California probably more than any other place other than D.C., so I guess that doesn't make me a great heartland journalist. But what I would say about California is it's very strange, where the problems are so obvious, you know, the extreme wealth and the extreme beauty, but also the extreme inequality and, you know, the extreme desperation. And, you know, just so much of the state's politics are defined in opposition to this sort of looming specter of Republicans, you know, back east. And it's not really specifically defined, right? Newsom very often does not put forward a positive vision of himself. He merely defines himself in negation to Trump and the Republicans. And, you know, he's stuck with that strategy against Elder, and it appears to be effective. But obviously, that's not exactly what you want to see from the leadership of the largest state in the country.
Right. It should be a lesson for all of those Republicans that fall prey to the siren song of, you know, just be positive and let's not exploit the differences. Let's, you know, put forward a forward-looking agenda and so on and so forth, when the left plays boogeyman politics the way that Newsom is, and they do so often to great success.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's extraordinary. I mean, one wonders if Elder will look at the race in 2022, if they recall again, because Newsom will have to run again in 2022 if he doesn't get recalled. You know, he only got in this race about 2 months ago in July, so he's one of the later ones. This is, to be clear on Newsom, this is an exasperated, exhausted political entity. And, you know, he's trying to hold on. But I think, you know, if he doesn't hold on, he wasn't as meek as Gray Davis, and he didn't have as plausible a successor as Schwarzenegger, would be the bottom line.
He is Kurt Mills, contributing editor at the American Conservative, AmericanConservative.com. Kurt, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Hear about the big stories of the day, then talk about them right here on Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Time now for another reason why Dan Proft is single.
Annie Wright, 21, just got out of a toxic relationship.
I know how that could be. Yeah.
Sure.
We've all been there, Dan. Yes.
Yeah. She happened upon 23-year-old Michael Head, who's a law student. And after just a short time of dating, Michael said, "I want us to be boyfriend and girlfriend." And Annie thought that was a good idea,
but not
without stipulations. She drafted a 17-page relationship contract for Michael. The contract came with four main objectives: honesty, communication, awareness of partner's needs, and clarity and alignment in their intentions.
What is the last one? The first three I understand. But the last one?
Yeah. Right.
Clarity and alignment. What, can you repeat that? And their intentions?
Yeah, and their intentions.
Okay.
Good thing that Michael is an aspiring attorney. we printed out terms and conditions. I went over to his place. We sat on either end of the bed and we read them aloud.
I felt
like the biggest issue I had in my last relationship felt like boundaries of mine were crossed that I never established. I was like, this time I'll write them out and no one can cross my boundaries. Michael's also pre-law, so he was pretty keen on the idea of making a contract. And she asked for a romantic gesture once every 2 weeks and to work out at least 5 times a week. We treat our relationship almost like a business interaction. We deal with conflict like partners in business world. We sit down and treat it more like we're partners in life, and love is an added bonus. Would you like to place odds on the outcome of this relationship?
I don't think it's gonna work out.
This has been a game changer, says young Annie. She recommends all couples have one. It's the best thing ever. People just fall into relationship. And the 17-page contract, makes me know what I'm signing up for. I live in constant fear of waking up 2 years into a relationship and realizing my partner doesn't have the same life plan as me. You put 1 or 2 years into a relationship, but you don't agree on the core things. If you don't have that core connection, you're wasting time and prolonging heartbreak.
Okay.
What do you think? Relationship contracts. If I was to do a relationship contract, there would be a lot of riders in mind that I'm not sure I'd get agreement on. And there'd be a lot of things in these categories that Annie has probably not agree to either.
What would be your first demand? Or, yeah, it's a demand. It's not a suggestion.
No, sure. My
that
first
they have
demand,
to be registered Republicans?
Well, right. You need that spelled out in a contract that you're sort of philosophically and spiritually aligned. My first demand would be that we don't do a relationship contract.
Ever.
And, oh boy. And that Michael had, he has no idea, that pre-law student, he has no idea what he's in for. He thinks this is a good idea now, but all the way down to scheduling romantic gestures once every 2 weeks. Talk to me in 6 months, kid.
All right. Thanks so much for making us part of your morning. Thanks to George Hoffman, who's in for Justin Kosick. By the way, Justin's celebrating his anniversary today. We'll ask him about it tomorrow, right, Dan?
And we'll also ask him if he has a contract. Well, in his case, since he's engaged, a prenup.
He probably does have a contract. And thanks also to Quinn McCarthy, our executive producer. We'll see you tomorrow morning at 5 a.m. Have a glorious day.
Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.